Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Jim Garrity is back from Ireland. A very convenient week for him to be away. David French did a great job in your stead last week, Jim, but it's always good to have you back. Hope you had a good and restful and fun vacation, and welcome back to Washington.
It was wonderful, and it's good that I was away during such a quiet week with nothing significant going on. No dramatic changes or anything like that. I jokingly asked on Facebook, so anything big happened while I was gone? And someone said, yes, David French got drunk on martinis at midday. So thanks to him for stepping in and on what sounds like a very busy and in many ways a week of grim news. So look, hopefully this one will be better. It's not like the sun's going to disappear or anything, right?
That's right. It's the total eclipse of the sun, because that parody, that pun hasn't been overdone at all here in the last few weeks. But yes, by the time a lot of folks hear this, perhaps the eclipse will have already gone past where you are. It's supposed to be around 1 or 2 or something Eastern time. I do not plan to blow up my retinas this afternoon, but I might peek out the window from time to time to see how much darker it gets. I don't know about you, Jim.
You know, Greg, for a mere $5,000, I will come to your house and I will install a home total solar eclipse simulator. Now, to certain minds, this might just look like a dimmer switch that you can use to adjust the lights in your home to be very bright, to very dim, to off, and then back up to bright again. But, you know, I can do that just about any time. But, hey, That's the big deal. That makes everybody very excited. This is the sort of thing where if we lived in like prehistoric South America or some of these cultures, if we knew about it ahead of time, we would look like, you know, prophets and sages and all that kind of stuff. But as is, it's just like people apparently having riots at Walmart over how to get the special glasses.
Amazing. Amazing. I should point out that Mrs. Corumbus and I spent a weekend in lovely downtown Charlottesville, planned long before the events of recent days. But by all accounts, while there's still certainly a bit of a somber tone, somber atmosphere near the site of where the horrific terrorist attack that took the life of Heather Heyer took place, there is a vibrancy still to Charlottesville. And while it was a little more somber than it probably usually is at this time with all the students and their families coming back, there's definitely a resolve and a resilience there. And so that's good to see. And hopefully they will be able to get focused on what they need to get focused on soon. The University of Virginia might be getting going. The University of Missouri here, as we get to our good martini. Well, let's just say they're a little bit down on their revenue. Jillian Melchior, writing over for the Wall Street Journal, I believe she is a National Review alum. She mentions the fact that a lot of Missouri alumni back in 2015, when all the campus protests were going on there, did not like what they saw, particularly the administration caving into all of these social justice warrior demands. And they mentioned and threatened that they were going to cut off their support. They weren't going to come to games anymore. They weren't going to do this and do that. And it turns out a lot of them actually made good on those protests. So Jillian writes, quote, as classes begin this week, freshman enrollment is down 35% since the protests, according to the latest numbers the university has publicly released. Mizzou is beginning the year with the smallest incoming class since 1999. Overall enrollment is down by more than 2,000 students to 33,200. The campus has taken 7 dormitories out of service. The plummeting support has also cost jobs. In May, Mizzou announced it would lay off as many as 100 people and eliminate 300 more positions through retirement and attrition. Last year, the university reduced its library staff and cut 50 cleaning and maintenance jobs. Mizzou's 2016 football season drew almost 13,000 fewer attendees than in 2015. Local media reported during basketball games, one-third of the seats in the Mizzou arena sat empty, although in all defense of the school, they were terrible in those sports, so the attendance might have been down for that reason. Jillian goes on to point out that there's also probably backlash at places like Yale and Middlebury, but those are private schools, so they don't have to release information like we just read about in Missouri. So, Jim, you know, free speech is out there, and free speech and free expression from alumni is alive and well, too, it would seem.
Yeah, and this is just to be a good, useful, cautionary tale. One of the comments that I like in Jillian's article here, she points out that, you know, she, because of the FOIA request, she got some emails by campus administrators who said, this is a PR nightmare, and quote, think of all the middle-of-the-road people we're losing. There's apparently an email sent to them saying that you've become the Berkeley of the Midwest. One of the reasons you don't want to be the Berkeley of the Midwest, besides ideological reasons, is that there's already Berkeley. you don't need to create a second one. You don't, you know, that if there's a certain market for a kind of student who wants to go to Radical U, where life is going to be full of protests and people needing safe spaces and all of that, fine, they can do that. But there's really no good reason for the University of Missouri, which has built itself on a very distinct and separate set of criteria, things that make them what they are or what they were. There's no need to be Berkeley again to reproduce that. Whatever market there is for it is limited to the folks who'd want to go to the existing crazy radical campuses. Well, now you see the consequences. Now you see what happens when you try to become the Berkeley of the Midwest. And what's really kind of revealing about these emails is that deep down, at least some of these administrators knew the problem that they were stepping into. They realized the likely consequences of this, but they didn't have the courage to stand up and say, no, this is wrong. Sorry, football team. Look, we are not going to go browbeat ourselves about white male privilege and all of these things. We're not going to change the curriculum. We're not agreeing to quotas for our faculty and staff. We have our standards and the way we operate. And if you don't like it, you're perfectly free to transfer to another university. But this is the way we've chosen to run the University of Missouri. That would have been the right course then. They didn't do that. And now we see the consequences. So one, hopefully other university administrators will learn the lessons of this. And two, maybe this is a lesson to everybody else. You don't prosper. You don't thrive. You don't grow. You end up killing off the institution you have built. And it's a very interesting metaphor you can apply to, say, ESPN or other institutions in which social justice warriors and these crazy lefty radicals get onto it, change its mission from whatever it originally was to the social justice warrior mission. And they're like a parasite killing off the host. Right. All of a sudden, the purpose of the university is not to educate people, but to serve the SJW agenda. All of a sudden, the purpose of ESPN is not just to tell you the down and the score and who's winning, but it's to educate you about all these great social issues going on and stuff like that. So on the one hand, it's kind of reassuring. It's frustrating to us to watch the social justice warrior crowd come in and take over these institutions and change them. On the other hand, the fact that they crash and burn is an indication that no, we aren't being swept up at this grand revolution or something like that, that you don't get anywhere when you listen to the campus radicals. And in fact, you could end up killing off the campus.
Amazing. All right. Well, people are talking with their feet and they're talking with their wallet. Let's move on to the bad martini now, Jim. And this story hasn't gotten a lot of attention yet, but ISIS apparently came very close to getting a massive bomb on board an international airliner. Here is Fox News reporter Benjamin Hall with a lot of the details.
This original plot was disrupted on July the 29th. The suspects had actually built the bomb, had taken it to the airport, but for reasons unknown had abandoned the plan before going through security. What we're now learning is that for more than 3 months prior to that, the two suspects, brothers named Khalid and Mahmoud Kayat, were being directed, instructed, and supplied by an ISIS commander inside Syria. What's more, all the components needed for the airplane bomb, including the plastic explosives and devices needed to set it off, had been shipped to Turkey, from Turkey to Australia by air cargo, probably in a passenger jet, allowing those brothers to build the bomb with instructions from the ISIS commander in Syria.
And here's a couple of lines from the Fox News story that goes along with it. A Barbie doll and a meat grinder, each packed with explosives, were the weapons of choice of the terror cell behind a foiled plot to blow up an Australian airliner, a Lebanese official said Monday. The bombs didn't make it aboard the intended flight because the piece of luggage they were hidden in was about 15 pounds over the airline's limit. And that might be the only reason this thing didn't get on board. So, Jim, we obviously saw ISIS pretty closely involved with the terrorist attack in Spain last week. Now it looks like they had even more sinister things up their sleeve.
You know, Greg, having just flown internationally, on behalf of every passenger who's ever gotten there and found out that your suitcase is over the weight limit and you got to unpack it right there in front of everybody and then you're unzipping and you're trying to figure out whether your jeans weigh more than your your shoes and whether they'll fit in your carry-on and you're jamming stuff on. It's embarrassing and people can see your worn underwear and all the frustration that comes with the weight limits. Finally, the weight limits are good for something, which is to keep bombs off of this Australian flight. The other thing I'm just kind of curious, though, Greg, who packs a meat grinder in their suitcase?
I don't know.
I mean, are you just really into sausages? And, you know, oh, I can't use any of the meat grinders they have there. I need this particular meat grinder or something like that. I mean, the unfortunate potential lesson of this is that from now on, terrorists will put their meat grinders in their carry-ons. Until you mentioned this to me, I had not heard any of this. This is not getting an enormous amount of attention here in the U.S. And I guess, you know, a flight from Australia to Abu Dhabi, an unsuccessful attempt at an attack is not nearly as big a news as an attack. And we have had the attack in Barcelona and possibly one up in one of the Nordic countries. But look, this is a big deal. We hear earlier this year all the talk that they were going to ban laptops or electronic devices on flights entering the U.S. and things like this. It is, you know, every time you have a near miss like this, which is, you know, basically a matter of luck, and this strange arbitrary weight limit you put for suitcases is the only thing that stops a terrorist plot. It is unnerving, and a recognition that the terrorists are still out there. They're still trying to kill us, and they seem to remain obsessed with planes. Which is a key part of the kind of the international global economy and, you know, how people get around. So, you know, thankfully they stopped this case. I will attempt to speak highly of those fine folks within Transportation Security Administration, and not merely because I'll be flying abroad again in the not too distant future and I only want to get groped lightly.
All right. Well, here's one little addendum to this story. There's four brothers who are allegedly involved in this plot. Two of the brothers are being held now in Australia. Another one is a senior member of the Islamic State terror group based in Raqqa in Syria. The fourth brother, Amer, was supposed to be on board the plane working to bring it down, but got himself arrested in Lebanon after he arrived in mid-July from Australia. Jim, you think he drew the short straw and realized that maybe getting arrested might have been the better play than being aboard the plane that got blown up in the sky?
You know, Greg, you don't see a lot of veteran suicide bombers. It's very tough to say, look, let me teach you how I did it successfully so you can learn from my example. So, yeah, that's kind of, you know, you thought you had sibling rivalry.
He's not the oldest brother, I'll promise you that. All right, Jim, let's move on to the crazy martini now. And the big story that broke on Friday after David and I finished recording for the week was that Steve Bannon is leaving the White House, whether he got fired, whether he had resigned over a week earlier and it was just now becoming official. Who knows? But he was basically given a heroic return over at Breitbart with the headline, I believe, something to the effect of Stephen K. Bannon returns home, and then in quotes, populist hero. At the same time, one of their other editors, Joel Pollack, was tweeting out hashtag war. Bannon gave an interview, I think it was with the Weekly Standard, where he said that the Trump presidency that we worked for and achieved is over as far as we can tell. And then there's promises of war with the Trump administration, promises of war with Rupert Murdoch. Apparently he's not happy with Fox for some reason. What kind of mess do you expect to come out of all this?
It is rather striking when he announces the Trump presidency that we built is over. I look at the calendar, I see 3.5 years to go. So if it kind of gets everything wrong, you know, it's like, oh, no, never mind. We're all done. There's nothing good that can come out of this. We're all kaput. No reason to have particularly high hopes. Julius Krind was one of the editors of this. He created this publication called the Journal of American Greatness. He was one of the trying to make the intellectual case for Trumpism. He wrote in the New York Times this past weekend, "I voted for Trump and I sorely regret it." Basically saying he had tried to give Trump the benefit of the doubt every conceivable way. He's committed too many unforced errors and deserves most of the blame for its failures. Far from making the transformative deals he promised voters, his only talent appears to be creating grotesque media frenzies, just as all his critics said. I also notice Ann Coulter is apparently, he says, "I'm ticked off with the emperor god." And you know, if Trump wants to prove he didn't get the good ideas from Bannon, then it better be pedal to the metal on deportations, the wall, a tax hike on people who make more than $5 million a year, which I understand was Bannon's idea. And you see, you know, she points out that Wall Street is cheering. You know, Greg, it's just a terrible shame that no one warned them. that during the 2016 campaign, there were no one on the right who was willing to say that Trump was erratic and mercurial and quick to lash out at people, that he had no real grounding in policy and arguably not much of an interest in policy, that he didn't know American history, he didn't know how the government works. If only someone had told them. Then maybe this could have been prevented or something like that. I suppose folks like myself who are skeptical of Trump should be, you know, rather warmer towards people who find themselves edging closer to the Trump skeptic position. But there's a part of me that just says, you guys, like, you totally assured us this wasn't going to happen. You totally assured us that this guy knew what he was doing, that he was this master deal maker, that, you know, passing all this stuff through Congress would be easy, that he, you know, he... guys, we warned you about this. This, he is the same guy he was a year ago and 2 years ago and 3 years ago and before all that. So it's rather baffling to see this. The other thing is that, you know, I am by no means a fan of Steve Bannon. I do start to think that Trump doesn't really have senior advisors, Greg. I think he just has scapegoats in waiting. Because, you know, was Bannon a problem? Was he leaking a lot? Yeah, probably. Was he fighting with the rest of the staff? Yeah, probably. Did he probably make a mistake in fighting with the president's daughter and son-in-law? Yeah, probably. But in the end, it's not like, you know, Bannon put a gun to the president's head and made him do any of these things. Bannon, you know, fought for his viewpoint in that administration. It's worth noting how much Bannon got the short end of the stick. Bannon, you know, did not win in a whole bunch of these key impressive fights. There's almost a little bit of a sympathy idea that the guy who kept losing the fights was the problem in all this. Really? I don't think that adds up that way. And then finally, the last thing I'll point out, Bannon apparently called up this this contributor to a left-wing publication who had written some things on trade that that he agreed with. And he just started talking to him. He pulled a Scaramucci. Apparently, he either didn't know or didn't care that he had not specified that the conversation was off the record. He's chatting, and one of the things he said is like, look, there's no option there's no military option that can work in North Korea. They got us. Now, on the record, knowingly or unknowingly, and saying things like, yeah, everything the president's saying about a massive military response, yeah, that's not going to happen. We're bluffing. You know, that's bad. That doesn't necessarily mean, by the way, that Bannon's assessment of the situation is wrong. When he says they got us, yes, we now are at a point with North Korea where there is a greater than zero chance that if it gets into a military conflict, North Korea could attempt to nuke an American city. Now, would their nuke work? We don't know. Would we be able to shoot it down? We don't know. Would their intercontinental ballistic missile work? We don't know that either. There's a whole bunch of variables in this. But the development they've made in their long-range missile programs and in their nukes have basically changed the calculus of any military conflict on the Korean Peninsula. Of all the things Steve Bannon has done, I don't know if Steve Bannon should be fired for telling the truth. Right? That might be the least bad thing Steve Bannon has done. He probably shouldn't have said it on the record, but, you know, all he's doing is acknowledging something that's fairly clear to anybody who's looked at the issue. So I suppose happy trails, Steve Bannon. He's back at Breitbart. As I kind of alluded to in the Morning Jolt today, if you look at the Breitbart traffic numbers, at least the ones that are publicly disclosed, they had a really weirdly sudden jump and then a weird sudden decline in their traffic. And not on the type of slopes you might expect. I mean sudden, like somebody turned on and off a switch. So did he turn Breitbart into this massive media voice? Or as I put it this morning, a good question is perhaps, did Trump create Breitbart.com, at least the 2016 edition? Or did Breitbart create Trump? And I'm thinking I'm leaning more towards the former than the latter. Trump is still in the White House. Trump is still in the position to have the final say in all these things. Bannon is now a guy with the conservative news website, or I'm making air quotes. You can't see that because this is an audio podcast. I should remember these things. I'm a little out of sync here, Greg, but I'm glad to be back for the next week. And we will see what happens. Somebody did ask us if we can start tallying how many good, bads, and crazies we have to see if the world really is getting crazier than it seems. And that seems like a fair proposal. Maybe I'll try to keep track of that as the days go on.
Oh, sure. The idea comes up at the end of intern season. Thanks a lot, whoever came up with that idea. Jim, Bannon's back at Breitbart. You're back at the 3-Martini Lunch. We definitely got the better end of that comparison. Welcome home, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to tune in again on Tuesday for the next 3-Martini Lunch.